So I'm trying to query. I'm trying to think of an example. Let's say you have accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take an accounts and contacts example.
Okay.
So let's say you have a field on contact called, let me think of something. Birthday. That's a standard field, right?
Yep.
Birth date, I think.
On the contact it is.
Yeah. On contact. Yep. And what you want to do is you want to query all, I'm trying to think of, I don't know if this example is going to work. I'm going to just roll with this. So you want to query the contact from each account with the oldest birth date. So contacts or accounts have multiple contacts. You want the contact from each account that has the oldest birthday.
Okay.
Pretty simple to do in SQL. You know, you basically query from contacts and then you join that to a subquery where you're doing an aggregate query. You say select, men, I guess it would be men birth date,
mm-hmm.
group by contact ID or account ID or whatever.
Okay.
And then you just join against that. And that's the kind of stuff you can't do in SQL. There's like, you know, SQL is, it's, yeah, I guess it's a very basic query language. And they do keep adding stuff. In fact, I saw in Spring 24 that they've added the ability to do multiple, I think four levels of parent to child. Yeah, parent to child. So you still only have one level of parent to child, like the one where you have a parentheses. It's almost like you write a subquery in your select list.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So you could only have one, couldn't nest those. You couldn't have like parentheses, you know, select ID from right. contact. And within that, like, oh, now I'm going to also select like activity from that. But now you can up to four levels, which is pretty nice.
Yeah, that is pretty nice.
It's an improvement. So you know, they're improving things, but still, you know, the SQL is just, doesn't offer it. Very little of the kind of power and flexibility and analytic capabilities of SQL. It'd be nice if they, and it's, I know it's not the goal of SQL. SQL is more close to a, like a JPA or I'm trying to think like, what's
almost
it?
Almost like a Lambda data selector almost.
It is more of a data selector.
Yeah.
Than it is a
query language.
Full query yeah. language. So, yeah.
But that's only because we're comparing it against things like SQL and stuff like that.
Yeah. And I mean, SQL's been around for 40, 50 years or whatever it is.
And I think what hampers it when we do that comparison and we talk about some of the things that you can't do, I think a lot of it has to do with joining or say subquery filtering where you can just join, say one text field to another text field on another.
No arbitrary joins. It's only just predetermined relationships is what your joins are.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, Salesforce is a highly managed platform. So, and of course, they have very much a not invented here. They've got a, you know, whether it's the query language, the programming language, the web component toolkit, everything's got to be.
Well, it's designed to prevent.
Everything's got to be proprietary, John.
And well, yes, but.
Because we are the Roach. This is the Roach Motel model of enterprise computing.
Well, to balance that out, I think. I understand what they're doing and why they're doing it because they're trying to prevent any kind of runaway query or something along those lines that would kind of impact the performance of the system since we are in a shared resource kind of environment with other customers. It's not like we own all those resources and can max them out per our leisure.
I guess. I mean, I don't know. Like literally every other SaaS database thing in the world lets me do SQL queries and they seem to not fall over. So I don't know.
True, but I think it's part of their earlier design decisions on the way they architected it and the way they decided to protect the system. Maybe back then it makes sense, but maybe nowadays it probably doesn't. But
it's technical debt now. It's too expensive to change
it.
Yeah. Investors don't give a shit about that. Until it stops preventing sales, then that's when they care.
Well, yeah. I mean... Yeah.
Well, John, I got called out for my exaggerating on how long it takes to run unit tests. or what we affectionately call unit tests. The truth is, there's really no unit tests in the Salesforce world.
I have a tangent on that, by the way, but okay. I'll let you talk.
And I feel like, you know, I mean, everyone probably saw this who's in the Slack. By the way, if you're not in Slack, www.gooddaysirpodcast.com, click on community, join the Slack. Most people that are in the community saw this. But anyway, yeah, somebody called me out for, I guess, exaggerating a little bit on how long it takes to run tests. And to some degree, I agree with that. I probably was exaggerating a little bit. But I don't even remember what metric. I think I said, you know, it takes 30 seconds to run a single unit test or something like that. And so first of all, you gotta kind of break this down. People showed some examples of like, hey, here, if you design your code well, look at how long it takes my test to run. You know, the tests take like, you know, 70 milliseconds or something.
No, none of them can go to 70 milliseconds.
Oh, some of them were in the, you know, like, I swear, in the couple hundred milliseconds.
And I think this was talked about in that thread as well, and it's worth pointing out now, which is why I'll go on this tangent, is that the timer that you see on the results doesn't start until after after everything is provisioned to enable this test to start.
Yeah.
There's a whole kind of lead up to that that isn't counted in that timer.
And you know what? And I don't care. The metric that Salesforce reports on how long things take, why do I care about that metric? I don't care about that metric. That doesn't affect me. What affects me is when I push the button or I save the file and an auto test runs or whatever, depending on how your development environment set up. What I care about is how long it takes the damn thing to get a result back to me.
Right.
And I don't care if some internal process took 120 milliseconds that it should be an implementation abstraction to me that I don't even see. I don't care about that. What I care about is I push the button and then how long do I take to get a response? That's what I care about.
Yeah.
And that for running even a simple test that does nothing, touches no data, I mean, is going to be several seconds. It's in the seconds. And which doesn't sound like very long, right? But usually this is around order magnitude 10 seconds to get a response back from running a unit test that does absolutely nothing.
Sure.
And, you know, when you look at developer workflows on other platforms, that type of test you have a result before you can even move your eyes to that part of the screen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you work in Java or JavaScript or Ruby or Python, I mean, that's, you know, it's kind of how you have your environment. Usually you'll have it set up. You'll have like a server, like a server running, and then a watcher.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to, I mean, there's so many different ways to set this up, but I'm just like one example. You can have a watcher set up that anytime you, save some kind of code file, it will immediately run any tests related to that. And I remember David Hanemeyer Hansen. I've actually looked for this tweet. I couldn't find it. This is like 10 years ago, probably. But he was like with our Ruby tests. And he said, you know, when I hit save or whatever after I've edited some Ruby class file, and by the time my eyes move over to that part of the screen, because he's got like a, you know, kind of four windows, and one of them's got like his tests or whatever. By the time my eyes move over to that part of the screen, we expect to have the result already. Now, that's for something that's going to run 1, 2, 3 tests and unit tests. These are not something where, we have to spin up a, you know, test containers and to launch an Oracle database instance. We have to populate the schema and cdata. No, I'm not talking about that. That's obviously, that's going to take more time. Right. Those are more end-to-end or integration functional tests, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about really just unit tests. And that's the kind of thing that, and I will say Hyperforce for most things seems to be providing more consistent performance, which I appreciate. There have been some things which I've, talked about a few times, which is like the bulk data load. What's it called? Bulk API. API. They've had some real problems with the speed of that on Hyperforce. I don't know why. It's some quirk, and I actually haven't seen that in like several weeks now. So maybe they've got that fixed. But in general, I think Hyperforce seems to have more consistent performance, and I think that really applies to a lot of the like tooling API stuff and just like saving Apex, running Apex tests, things like that seem to be more consistent because on, it's not too long ago where you, I would have, you know, I'd, you'd be in a situation where you'd run a unit test and it, maybe it takes 5 seconds to run. You run it the next day, same one, 30 seconds. I'm like, oh, what's going on here? I mean, and that's just brutal. I mean, and I think to most people have to some degree, some varying level of ADD, you know, and more than 5 seconds for a developer is dangerous. Because what are you going to do? You're going to immediately, now this is me, and I, you know, and these are my flaws. I'm going to immediately flip over to Twitter or Slack or something. And next thing I know, it's 5 minutes later. I'm like, oh shit, what was I even doing? And this happens to me 1,000 times a day.
Yeah.
And so that's why you really, and nowadays computers are so ridiculously fast and cheap and internet is gigabit and everything too, everything else. Like there's really, it's hard to justify that a not kind of anything less than kind of a top-notch developer experience.
Yeah.
But I think Hyperforce seems to be way more consistent. I've noticed that, you know, I mean, a unit test may take me 7 seconds to run it, which is more, a lot more time than I would like it to take. But it's at least it's about 7 seconds every time, you know, give or take a couple of seconds.
So it's consistently slow.
Title.
I mean, I can only speak to whenever we do our deployments, and that sucker still takes a good hour for everything to run. Now, a lot of that is our own.
You're running your entire suite, right?
We're running the entire suite, and a lot of it is our own doing. There's a lot of automation on things that are very inefficient. There's no way to escape out of automation while we're doing test data setup.
Kills me. I just want to go. Can we go back to no automation? S controls only.
Oh, man.
It just causes so many problems. And 90% of my work nowadays is all data work. And a lot of times it's large volumes of data. And just, I'm like, okay, I need to load 250,000 contacts, and they're going about 100 every minute through the bulk API. And I'm just like, oh my God, this automation is just, it's just so, so, so slow.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to blame that on. Cause you know, I probably should spend some more time on the flame graph on the log explorer or log analyzer. You ever use that plugin on Visual Studio? It's pretty cool. You don't have to really use Visual Studio Code. Like you can to capture the log. I just don't use Visual Studio Code. Well, I don't use it for Salesforce. I use it for text editing. Mm-hmm. but you can just open a log file and you can invoke that plugin and it gives you like this, I guess it's a flame graph, but I mean, every time, you know, a trigger is entered or a flow is entered or all whatever, like you see this. And you can, and they're all nested, so you can see like it gives you a good visual on kind of figuring out what's taking time. So I probably should spend some more time with that. But I mean, it's like got a few triggers, got some flows, and it's just like all of a sudden, like you go from being able to load, I don't know, several, you know, certainly hundreds of thousands of records per hour, maybe even in the millions of records per hour, down to like 10,000 an hour or something, or if that, it just doesn't seem like it should be that that slow. But I don't know who, you know, obviously people, this, I feel like the Salesforce community does not value enough, the community at large does not value enough, you know, efficiency. And maybe this is like premature optimization. See, this is me talking out of both sides of my mouth. Maybe, well, I don't, you know, because I'm also against premature optimization.
I don't think it's that, though. I think it's a matter of behavior. And like you said, your behavior is that if you have to wait too long, you'll get easily distracted. The behavior that I see, because tests take so long, is that we don't run tests. A developer will wait till the end of coding to write a test. Yeah. Or they might even create a PR before they have the test figured out because they don't want to take the time to write it. You know, it's all of these things that drive behavior. In fact, one of the things I'm trying to address with my testing framework is reducing the burden on the developers in terms of data setup and things like that, with the ability to kind of create these predefined recipes that they can just kit together so that they have the data they need to test, so they can just focus on writing the actual test. And that's me trying to drive the behavior. It's not something they can't do on their own, but I'm trying to ease that burden so that they can get to writing the test faster and it's less of an issue for them to actually take the time to write it.
Yeah.
Because as an organization, we, in terms of code quality, we do want to be able to write these tests and rely on them for regressions. I mean, right now we're relying on our QE team for regression testing, and it's a huge burden across the entire platform. Because it's not just Salesforce. It's all the integrations and interactions that we have with other systems that we have to regression test. It would be better to have them focused on those type of regressions, the interoperability between systems, mm-hmm. versus trying to make sure that we didn't break a button, you know?
Yeah. No. Testing is always.
But yeah, I'm envious of anybody who's able to get a decent run on their tests. I mean, that's an accomplishment. It's worth celebrating. And
well, I will say, and I wouldn't want to call someone out, but I feel like I need to for this. Not call them out, but just mention. Because some people have written shared some good information out there on how to write Apex code, how to design Apex code so that tests do run fast. So, mm-hmm. It's honestly, it's code that's more similar to, like, I would say, like, you know, typical like Java patterns and things. So you know, coding to almost, you know, abstractions, like hard, you know, you really don't want to rely on concrete implementations of things. So abstractions, interfaces, whatever, abstract classes, so that those can be stubbed out. Not stubbed out. What's the word? And during test time, you can
be mocked.
Like mocks.
Yeah.
Stubs, whatever. So that you're not doing database stuff. And I have to look into this.
It's a balance, because even in that thread, someone else had mentioned that they came across an issue where their tests were passing beautifully, but it turns out that they had a wrong parameter in their query. And because this was all being run against fake data, meaning you run the test and you give it the data that it's going to return, meaning you're bypassing validating the system's actually querying the data that you want back. So there's pros and cons to it. I think it takes a good balance between maybe isolating and having some granular unit tests that don't rely on the database, but also having those upper level end-to-end tests that do database executions, transactions, and all those kind of things.
Yeah, you certainly have to have both. And that's why, you know, if you're going to go to the effort, because there's definitely a cost to designing. And by the way, it's Mitch Spano, so people should go to his blog. That's why I wanted to say that, because I think he's shared some pretty good stuff on this.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of other
people. Yeah, he seems to have a pretty mature development pipeline as well that I'm really envious of. I'm wondering how he got there.
And I don't know. I need to go look or ask.
I'm still stuck in tech debt to even. There's an okay?
Yeah, okay.
Ooh.
That was scaring me for a second. I haven't even looked. I need to go look at his website or his blog, whatever it is, to see if he shared anything on there. Just on their pipeline, their kind of test and deployment pipeline. I know he said they've done a ton of work and they've got like a really, I'm sure it's like very custom to them, but a really nice setup that's better than any of these commercial things. And there's so many, by the way, some of these commercial things, this is also a smell.
Like, it is.
Why can no one solve this problem well? And they can't solve it at a reasonable cost either.
No, they can't.
It's just...
We were reevaluating some of our usage of some of these tools and whether or not to re-up our contracts with them. But some of the things that we wanted to use that we thought we could would make the cost worth it ended up being in a separate tier that costed additional pricing. So it wasn't even like we could try to justify the current cost, because the things we wanted to do to try to justify the cost to our business was already in a extended cost tier.
Yeah. Well, John, let's see. What do we? Anything else on that testing speed?
Speed. Now I know it's a hard problem to solve. I know there's a lot of things from the platform that make it difficult. So I don't want to sit here and like just moan and complain as if it should be better. But I think it could be better. But I also know that the tension's not there. I don't see them pausing Mm-mm. to solve that issue, because it does work. You just have to wait a bit longer for it.
No, and if you, I mean, go to the release notes and just look at like go scroll down to the metadata API section. It's very sad, very 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 sad.
Yeah, the metadata is a sad story for sure.
And by metadata, I just mean I'm including in that like the API deployment, all the whole design of the whole thing. But yeah, it's I don't know. All right. Well, let's see. I kind of wanted to. I do have a couple of release notes things. At least I thought I did.
Oh, I was looking at those and I meant to.
I do,
yeah. To make some notes, but I didn't get a chance to.
But also, and of course, I think the Informatica.
I was saving that.
Okay, so just in the case anyone's been under a rock or doesn't read Salesforce news all the time, there was a rumor that Salesforce was looking to acquire Informatica.
Mm-hmm.
And Informatica is one of these old school integration product solution platform things. Have you worked with Informatica?
I think I did for a while. Too. Yeah.
It was a long time ago. I did a long time ago. And then not as long ago, I did some work with Informatica Cloud.
Mm-hmm.
Which at the time, now it was fairly new, but wow, garbage product. Terrible, terrible. I'm sure it's way better now. I mean,
it's always hard to transition a native desktop app into the cloud.
Yeah. This was so bad.
Yeah.
It was so bad.
Especially since their product relied so much on like visual aids.
Because
you had your mapping and you had your diagrams. I think it used like a schema diagram thing to design the mappings and the direction of things and everything. I think that's pretty hard to translate.
Just to pick on another one, you know what else? I'm just surprised because I think they're considered like a somewhat of a leader in the space. But I think it's just terrible. Is Jitterbit. It's terrible. I mean, the tools that you have to use, it's like, what? This is,
well, I think just
how,
like,
how is this so expensive and it's so bad?
Well, because I think it gained its popularity when it was open source.
Was Jitterbit ever open source?
I thought it was. Wasn't it Jitterbit?
You're thinking of something else. Maybe Talon?
Talon, that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, Talon's got Camel embedded in it. I mean, Mule basically kind of has Camel embedded in it, if you want to go there, but we won't do that right now.
Well, I just wonder, like on products like that, they tend to have a pretty big loyal community, given that they were open source.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times whenever they transition to some enterprise cost, they'll roll those numbers in of the community to say, hey, look how great we are, how big we are, how we're used in everywhere, those type of things.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of inherit because of that community.
Yeah. But anyway, back to the story. Salesforce, you know, I was looking at, and that would be like over $11 billion acquisition. And it was about going, you know, that rumor was floating around for about a week. I'm sure the rumor was based on, I'm sure Salesforce was wanting to buy Informatica. I don't think it was like fake or anything.
No.
But I think as with like, fun callback. Remember when Salesforce wanted to buy Twitter? Or I should say Mark Benioff wanted to buy Twitter.
Yeah. It's hard to forget.
Well, and then like investors were like, nah, no, not happening. I kind of feel like that's what happened here a little bit. I'm not sure if this would have been great for Salesforce or MuleSoft, but as far as I can tell, now I haven't looked at the news in several days now. So I'm
assuming you mean Informatica?
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a Freudian slip, by the way.
What did I say?
You said MuleSoft.
Oh.
I was going to make the joke, why buy Informatica when you got MuleSoft?
I know. Well, this gets into the part of the problem with this acquisition. But anyway, I assume the deal is still off. It's not happening. But
well, I mean, I've got articles saying that the talks fell through and that.
It fell through.
Yeah.
I think it was just that, I mean, both companies, Salesforce and Informatica, both public companies, and both of their stock prices went down immediately when this rumor came out. It's like substantially. So if the investors don't want it, and also Informatica is, even though they're public, there is, I forget who it is, some hedge fund or someone owns like a majority or some private investment group or something owns a majority of their stock. And I think that organization was maybe not on board with this or something, which is weird. I don't know why, because I will say one of the disadvantages for Salesforce of this deal would have been that Informatica just basically, I think, doesn't make money. Kind of looked at their some of their more recent court, financial statements, and they didn't really make much money. I mean, they do, I don't know, a couple billion maybe of revenue a year. They're not, so they're not, I don't know.
I don't know. I'd be good with a couple of billion in revenue.
Maybe it was, a couple of billion?
No, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to look now. Anyway, but yeah, they don't, so they're not buying like a really, like a cash generating machine. It's not profit. It's not really real profitable. So it doesn't help them from that perspective. But anyway, I did write down some like advantages and disadvantages. So supposedly Informatica offers a broader set of tools in MuleSoft, especially so people talk about like data quality and security.
Mm.
And also Informatica has, they're kind of known for some kind of, they have some master data management solution, which I think it's funny that mastered, that is a term that apparently hasn't been obliterated by memes and commercial companies and the analysts and everything, because everything else gets destroyed. SOA or SOA, whatever you say.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, so many things. DevOps. What else? There's like we talked about these for.
That would probably 10 years now. Probably, I mean, so be many, because it's the most
become meaningless
practical
terms.
Way of solving the issue.
But master data management apparently is still a term, people. I mean, I know it is a term, but Informatica is well known for their master data management solution. It's just weird.
Well, because they've got a plethora, to use a fancy word, of connectors.
Well,
that's what's valuable in trying to enable that.
Yeah.
That master data. Because the issue that all these, the ones that you rattled off, is all about inter-system communication. It's all about talking to different systems. And one solution to that is to combine all the data into one place so that you can all reference it all and kind of sync up in that one place, which would be the master data. The other thing is the kind of real-time communication to get them just talking to each other. So they're not having to store anything. Whatever the system of record is still owns the record, but now you can talk and communicate and match things up and still get stuff done. But I think that turns out to be way more complicated to real-time communicate with systems than it is to kind of combine and say, okay, here's our snapshot of what everything is. You guys consume what you need. We'll refresh it tomorrow night. You can come talk to us later about what's new.
Yeah. I also just think so much of this is just like, it's just what they're known for. Cause it's the marketing that they chose to go with terminology. Like just like Mules is known for like
being an ESB, but doesn't want to be called an ESB.
They're not even known for that anymore. Because another term that was ruined, and it's such still a valuable concept, a service bus.
Well, I mean, in my opinion, that's what they are, but
it
became a bad word, and they're like, no, we're an API company.
Well, no, I was going to say, so MuleSoft is known for, even though I just think this is their, they don't own any better claim to this than any of these other companies do, but they're known as like the API prototyping and management and API gateway and all this, and like mm-hmm. all this stuff. And it's like, I mean, everything's APIs. How do you have some monopoly on APIs or have some special sauce on APIs? It's just, everyone does APIs.
Yeah. But they're the hub of the API. They're the bus of the API.
Sure. Okay. I mean, if you choose to make that your bus, but I mean, you can.
The value add that they would say is probably the monitoring of those APIs. Since everything's coming into the hub, all the what do you want to call it? All the transactions to those calls to those APIs.
So you have to re-architect your entire multinational enterprise and send everything through MuleSoft so it can monitor. They can monitor it. I mean, okay. Yeah. First of all, that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen. No one's doing that.
McDonald's did it.
Yeah.
That's how you get your cheeseburger from a kiosk, is it's MuleSoft, apparently.
Interesting.
That was one of their big success stories that they shared with us when we were doing the training.
What's that?
It was McDonald's. And how they're using it to run the kiosks and everything at the McDonald's.
Who was?
MuleSoft.
MuleSoft.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. Whatever makes you comfortable, Mr. CIO. Whatever.
You know, hey, I can order like twice as much food and not feel guilty about it because it's a machine, not a person looking at me with disgust.
I mean, these solutions, they all bamboozle you with their proprietary concepts, and then you get
I got some sediment there. Well, get a spoon.
I know. they just bamboozle you with all their your these buzzwords and proprietary concepts and things. And then it's like, oh,
I don't think it's a bad tool. I think it's a pretty good tool.
Which tool are you talking about?
MuleSoft. It's just, it's just an expensive offering.
They're all expensive.
You really have to have a big enough ecosystem to leverage it and make it cost effective.
It's too expensive.
That's the problem with all these. At least I'm not paying for them. No, MuleSoft's great. I mean, in terms of like these commercial integration solutions, and anytime I listen, if you're going to come to me and say, "Hey, we need you to use build integration, and you got to use, you know, MuleSoft," I'm like, versus Informatica or Jitterbit or whatever, I'm very happy to use MuleSoft. It's pretty well designed. I mean, they did copy Camel, so there's that. their models are almost identical.
Well, Informatica seems to benefit the same way Windows benefits in organizations. It's just been around for so long. It's widely used, and it's just kind of a company wanting to integrate Salesforce probably already has Informatica or something like that. They'll just want to plug it in.
Let's see. Informatica would be an important piece of the puzzle for Salesforce customers trying to prepare an ecosystem for generative AI and other advanced data science projects. Final advantage, acquisition would not only help Salesforce secure a new customer base. So that's one thing. I mean, anytime they acquire a company that's just got a big customer base, like theoretically they're getting some new customers. I mean, the question is like, who doesn't run Salesforce anymore at some part of their company, you know, that they're not already in. So,
Don't say that to implementation partners.
Oh, I know.
What, SIs? Sorry, system integrators. Is that what they call them? Is that what they call you guys?
I don't know.
I'm not in that world anymore.
Yeah. I don't know what they call us. I mean, I feel like it changes every year. It's like you're called a different thing or something.
I got a few choice words.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's see. This acquisition would not only help Salesforce secure a new customer base, but also provide it with a new product stream to increase the stickiness, Roche Motel, of its data management offerings while growing its revenue. These new customers for Salesforce are most likely to come from financial services, healthcare, and airline sectors where Informatica has a better foothold. So there's a little bit of an argument there. Just you're buying some customers.
Yeah.
Disadvantages? Well, number one.
It's too expensive.
Number two, will be confusing for customers. This is my comment here. Will be confusing for customers for years.
Oh, yeah.
See Tableau/Einstein Analytics.
Yeah.
Still confusing.
Well, not only for customers, I'm sure for the sales reps.
Coherent message. There's no coherent message.
I'm sure for sales too, who has to try to sell it, you know. How do you differentiate the two?
My other HSO is this: it would take a decade to fully integrate, if they ever integrated. Like the integration products solutions.
Oh, they won't.
It would never.
They've never proven to do that.
Nope.
No.
You just pave over. It's like when they excavate like under
Like where's Pardot now?
It is marketing cloud customer engagement or something like that. MCCE or yeah. I forget. I don't know.
That's the slow way of pushing it to the back with such a confusing name and just kill it.
So it's no. I think Pardot is not going anywhere. I think they were victimized by an unfortunate rebranding.
Yeah. Well, I think it has to exist just because of the cost and smaller business, but it's Salesforce isn't going to push it. I can promise you
Salesforce.
Here's Marketing Cloud. You don't need that. Okay, well, we do have this other product called Pardot, whatever its new name is, that has XYZ but doesn't have this. It's not going to be the first one they offer.
I don't know. In my experience, Salesforce is very happy to sell Pardot.
Oh, I'm not saying they're not happy to sell it.
Marketing Cloud engagement, whatever it's called.
I'm just saying they'll start the conversation with the Marketing Cloud.
But Marketing Cloud is so Microsoft SQL Server, you know? It's like, I don't know.
It doesn't matter anymore. It's on Amazon.
That's true.
Doesn't matter anymore.
It's, you just data cloud all your things together, right?
Yeah.
Final disadvantage. These are mine again. Informatica doesn't make money. And you know what? They've been around since like the 80s, I think, Informatica. I think at least 90s, if not 80s. And if So that makes them, what, a 40-year-old company, something like that? They still don't make money? Some ain't right. I mean, I know.
But they do have a new growth industry with trying to do data collection for AI. I mean, so that's a new avenue for them to attack. It could change things for them.
Okay, so yeah, Informatica's revenue is $1.5 billion. What's Salesforce's revenue? Like 30, 40? What is it?
It's the fastest 20, 10 billion.
Why is it not showing me the revenue? They're 40-ish, I think. So Salesforce is going from 40 billion to 41.5 billion with an $11 billion acquisition.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Just trying to like eliminate competition. But the problem is in the integration space, there's a billion different integration things out there of questionable quality.
I wonder if it's maybe Salesforce just trying to get back into growth mode again.
Yeah.
They're just too addicted to the growth numbers, to the growth stock.
That's what I'm saying. It just doesn't get them that much. A billion and a half.
Because here's what happened. And this is why I wanted to bring this.
It's not that much. It doesn't move the needle.
The reason I wanted to bring this topic up is because I have it labeled on my notes as PR hype. Because right after the stock went down because of all the Informatica hype, there's three titles that came up in my feed. Salesforce crowned king of CRM for the 11th year running. Salesforce improving profitability and robust cash flows. Why Salesforce Inc. could be worth watching. There's all these new positive headlines coming out more this week and even a little bit last week since the Salesforce Informatica thing came out.
Well, so what are you getting at, John?
Nothing.
Okay.
Just the hype cycle. You know, anytime Salesforce seems to take a dip because of something, there's a whole long end tail of positive PR stories that come out. They say nothing. They might point to some positive numbers in the financials, but they're not saying anything new. They're not exposing any kind of new thing that no one's ever thought of. They're just titles.
Well, let me, I got access to some private investor notes on this deal.
Uh-huh.
That'd be fun. I thought they were kind of juicy. Let's see. Though Salesforce management has emphasized data cloud success in recent quarters, our field work suggests a less constructive view with the product still relatively immature and CRM and Salesforce aggressively bundling and allocating revenue to data cloud in larger deals.
Uh-oh.
This is, again, you know, typical
shell game.
I don't know if that's the right metaphor, but it's something like that. Indeed, data integration within customers' CRM environments is complex. You have Salesforce clouds running on different code bases and different data models, giving Salesforce's acquisition history and a significant data/information sprawl outside of Salesforce, with customers often leveraging numerous other front office SaaS vendors, so like pipeline stuff, sales manager stuff, whatever. And then he says this has limited Salesforce's access to higher fidelity/quality data for even traditional BI and analytics. As generative AI adoption rises, this challenge will only get harder. So interesting. I don't want to go too much into the data cloud because I do think that data cloud is an important part of Salesforce's future. but. It's a young product. It's still a young, new product. And that's kind of what this, and this is, again, this is in the context of the Informatica acquisition or potential acquisition. Data governance and data quality have risen in strategic importance with the advance of generative AI as organizations modernize their data estates. Bringing Informatica's data management assets together with Salesforce's significantly larger organization could put Salesforce in a better position to capitalize off the data estate modernization discussion as it looks to supplement its data cloud offering. This
you know what that kind of sounds like?
That sounds like analyst gobbledygook to me.
No, you know what it sounds like to me? It sounds like on a number of big deals, they tried to push MuleSoft to get data into data cloud, and the company said, well, we've got Informatica. We could do that.
Oh, yeah, We don't need your MuleSoft.
Yeah.
You don't want our MuleSoft? Well, fine. We'll just buy your Informatica. then you'll have to pay us for it. If such a deal were to happen, it would be positive for small and mid cap data analytic companies, which is interesting. I'm not, like they mentioned, Teradata, Confluent, MongoDB. I don't understand that. Do you?
No,
I don't either.
Why are those?
I'm not sure. And here's the final comment here. This likely is not a good acquisition. Informatica's area faces huge competition, which we just talked about, like the hundreds of competitors. And they have always been either not profitable or barely so. So if you are buying engineers, remember Informatica laid off half its engineering force in the U.S. in an attempt to look profitable.
Mm.
That was recent. Informatica's AI tech is based on OpenAI, and similar results have been replicated by dozens, if not hundreds, of other lower-cost companies. There's really nothing original about it. A lot of ex-Informatica execs wound up at Salesforce, and likely they are pushing this acquisition. There is nothing about Informatica that can't be replicated at a 75% discount. And this is happening all the time in the market. That's why Informatica had to spend money on a huge R&D effort. The only thing that made Informatica better was a willingness to forgo any profit or even take a loss in order to match or more often acquire the same technologies. Best recommendation I can make is just to wait a year. In that time, Informatica's hype farm will be exposed and you'll be able to buy Informatica at a 50% discount. So maybe let's track Informatica stock. We'll buy it when it goes down. And I say this because
learn from the Slack acquisition.
Yeah. Informatica will have to spend R&D money to match competition in their space, which is constant and requires low capital investment. Spending $12 billion on Informatica is basically like throwing $10 billion away.
Wait a minute, say that again?
Spending $12 billion on Informatica is like throwing $10 billion away. Again, it's not worth it.
It's kind of our throwaway culture, isn't it? Rather than invest to make something better, just better to buy a new thing.
And every time we talk about like potential acquisitions, I get very empathetic. Like I'm always like, if that was my money, I wouldn't do this. And I'm always thinking about, you know, if it were me. And I do own some Salesforce stock. You know, I famously bought $1,000 worth or something like that. We should check out. We need to check it in on my Salesforce stock. It was down for like a year or two. But now I think it's back in the black.
Yeah, it should be. I don't know if I have it on my watch.
Yeah, they really came back. It was about a year ago. They were like 5-year low or something like that.
Something like that.
It's way back now. After those, thanks to the activist investors.
Yeah, you can thank them for that.
I guess. That's a whole other sticky
subject. That or AI, one of the two.
Yeah, no, not AI. I can promise you that.
What are you talking about?
I don't think AI is helping anyone except NVIDIA.
It's in my next topic. Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff says AI should be a human right.
Oh, I heard. Well, now we had to play the game. Who said it first? Because Sam Altman, I just saw, he just gave some. Where was it? Oh, I had it somewhere. Anyway, he gave some speech and he said that AI is a human right.
This all came from Davos. They all sat around drinking their margaritas.
How can something be a human right that doesn't exist yet?
Well, they also said the same thing about the internet.
Sorry, generative word salad is a human right. It's not a human right. What is it? I'm sorry. I shouldn't take these things seriously. I mean, because they're not meant to be. They're not meant to be taken seriously.
No, in the same way you have food, water, shelter as being kind of like the basic necessities of life. There's been a growing trend in the recent decades of including things like electricity as a human right. Internet is a human right.
Yeah.
And now AI is a human right. But I think that's just piggybacking off the internet human right.
I promise you, my electric company does not think electricity is a human right because they are very quick to send me that pink envelope that says we're going to be out here in 7 days to turn your electricity off. They do not care about my human rights.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think this the whole hyperbole and hype around it has just gotten insane. Oh, driving here today, I saw a billboard from, what is it? NFM, because they were, they were bad at naming their company, Nebraska Furniture Mart. They had to shorten it to NFM. It's like NKOTB all over again.
NFM. Yeah. I don't
know. Can you tell me what NKOTB is?
New Kids on the Block.
Oh, awesome. You said that too fast.
Everybody knows what that is.
but yeah, it was a billboard, and it said, it caught my attention because it used the word bespoke, which I can't stand that word anymore, but it was bespoke appliances with AI. I'm like, I don't need a dishwasher with AI.
That's so dumb. That's just, what's the dishwasher going to do with LLM?
I don't know. I don't know. It's going to learn how bad you are at cooking.
Was it like predict where it should shoot the next drop of water most efficiently or something? I mean, get out of here. This is dumb. This is.
You didn't rinse your plates before putting it in. I don't know.
But, you know, AI in your appliances is no less of a farce than AI in your enterprise software. It's not intelligent. It's artificial. It's not intelligent. Not yet. LLMs are not artificial intelligence. I'm sorry. They're statistical token producers. It's not intelligence. It's getting better. I mean, it's useful for some things.
I think Mitch Spano has his most recent article talks about the math around these machine learnings.
Okay.
And it's statistics. I can't say the word.
That's a hard
statistics.
Word. Yeah. Man, I tell you, just on LLMs, Facebook is really, I don't get their strategy because they're pouring a ton of money into open sourcing a ton of their LLM and AI work and stuff. And this is part of why it's just like, it's this weird race to the bottom. Like there's no money in having your own LLM model.
Well, I think people are trying to treat it like the next coming of the internet, which the internet
AI enabled.
The internet can exist on its own and it can produce things on its own, meaning new things can come about because of the internet that did not exist before. Mm-hmm. But no one's looking for that from AI, except for maybe some very specific industries. And everywhere else, they're trying to find ways to use AI in existing products. It's not like it's spawning a whole new industry. It's just finding new ways to apply these algorithms to current existing data applications. Now, Boston Dynamics or whatever the robot company is, they're doing some cool things, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how much of that's AI. I mean, there's...
Well, if they were an enterprise company, they'd be calling everything they did AI by now.
True, but
because any application that had any kind of smart statistical analyst or some kind of algorithm that could make somewhat of a decent decision based on data inputs is now calling themselves AI.
Sure, just like what was the tea company that renamed themselves like? Oh, was it the Arizona Iced Tea or one of those tea companies renamed their company to like something like blockchain iced tea and like their stock shot up.
But yet Boston Dynamics, who has robots that can actually freaking do somersaults, is not rushing to call their things AI.
No, they're just, you know, they have really good engineering and they got all the physics figured out. And there's a ton of machine learning. Absolutely. In those, what scares me is when their robots do get intelligent. That's what's scary. You don't want those. Have you seen those things?
Have you seen that they retired the, what was the last generation of bots? Was it Atlas or something?
No, I couldn't name any of them, so I don't know. Yep.
Anyways, the last generation of bots were hydraulic based for all their movement. Mm-hmm. And so they've retired those and they're moving on to fully electric
like
solenoid operations and stuff like that.
Yeah. Magnetics and stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, if you can get enough. I mean, the thing with hydraulics, you can get a lot of power with hydraulics.
Yeah. So I'm curious to see how that turns out, but
Well, so I do have a few release notes thing. What else do we want to talk about? I wanted to talk to you about, what was it? Microsoft. Are you following their ARM processor initiative here?
I've heard about it and I've been meaning to dig into it, but I've heard about it.
I thought I had some notes on it, but
it's interesting, isn't it?
Well, it is interesting because this Apple Silicon, right, which is Apple's ARM processors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I can't overstate, like, I think what a great advancement in their products that was. It's just such a game changer. Performance, battery, heat, everything.
But that does have a lot to do with the chip architecture.
It does. Yeah. Well, I mean, x86 is just a disaster.
Yeah. So I have a very cursory understanding of that, but my understanding is that the main difference is the instruction set and how the x86 architecture added a lot of instructions into the chipset that normally would not be in the chipset. So like ARM is a more low level basic chip instruction set. And that allows it to be more performant because it's not having to do so much. You can abstract that out into the software layer. Whereas the x86 has a lot of legacy that has to be built into
That's a good point. I never thought about that. So I wonder if ARM is RISC and x86 is
RISC. I thought that was, yeah, I could be wrong on that, but I thought it was.
Maybe that's one of the big differences. I also just think the x86, it just has so many like legacy registers and all kinds of bullshit.
Yeah.
That, you know, people who need to run their 1982 like inventory tracking software, like they still need all those registers. It's, you know, that program was compiled 40 years ago and it's not going to get recompiled and they still need to run it. You know, there's just all kinds of legacy software that, you know, for better or worse, Microsoft has cleaned up on. You know, like that's part of their cash cow is that they have this huge install base and Intel's benefit as well, considering they were the primary x86. I guess all of them made x86, you know, AMD and whoever else. But now Microsoft is, so they've been working on their own ARM processor. They say it's going to blow away the M3.
That's nice.
And they have a whole product line coming out around it.
Windows branded product line? Like, I'm sorry, Microsoft branded?
Yeah, I think so.
Same difference.
And I'm not sure there'll be like third party as well, like, you know, computers that have this, but yeah, they're going to have their own like Surface. Is that what it's called? Mm-hmm. Surface. And I think a couple of other things, but what's their conference? Build or one of these other ones? I don't know. But like the day before that conference, which is coming up in May, they're going to have a pre-day where they announce all this stuff. But I thought I had grabbed some highlights because I really don't want to like read articles here, but yeah, they call it their AI. First of all, they're calling these their AI PCs. Of course. And they say that these will beat Apple's M3 powered MacBook Air, both in CPU performance and AI accelerated tasks. What, John? This is an Ask John here. What is an AI accelerated task?
I have no idea. I gotta put in that clip of, it Benioff? I have no idea.
Oh, I do. I should have that. Let's see. No idea. Look at this, John.
I have no idea.
Yeah, that's my response. No idea.
Let's see.
I'm assuming because it's such a math intensive process that they've been offloading that to the GPUs, and with the system on a chip, they're able to offload that to the different cores pretty more efficiently.
This might be my favorite one so far. Okay. Let's see. So Microsoft is so it's Qualcomm that's making these chips for them, though. Microsoft's so confident in these new chips that it's got a number of demos that they're going to show how these processors are faster than M3 MacBook Airs. And they're saying that these AI PCs will have faster app emulation than Rosetta 2, which is weird. I mean, maybe it will. I don't know. But I that's one thing. When I did get this machine, which by the way I've had for I think longer than I've had any laptop now, maybe.
Probably you're pretty consistent about every two years replacing.
Yeah, but I have no desire to replace this now. It's just fast. It's fast. I think I don't know. It's got like 32 gig of RAM, or maybe it's got more than that. I don't even know. I forget. But obviously plenty, because I don't have to worry about that. I don't have to worry about RAM. I don't have to worry about my battery's still amazing. This computer's going to last me 5 years. I've never had that happen. That's never happened.
Yeah, I have 32.
But what I was thinking was when I got this, I don't remember installing. Does Rosetta just get installed automatically? Okay. I don't remember like installing it or configuring it or anything.
No. Yeah, it's just automatic.
But I feel like
it's AI. It's iOS.
So AI. So of applications that I run on my computer, how many do you think are not? I'm running an Intel binary, not an ARM binary. That's being having to be translated through Rosetta. Are there any left at this point?
Who knows?
Now that's much more important thing for Microsoft, because they're going to have rewind 30 seconds. They're going to have a ton of software that's always going to have to run through their emulation layer, because people are not going to recompile this all the software for now.
Well, it should be less than it used to be.
Current software will absolutely be. You know, they'll ship multiple dual binaries, basic type of thing. So you'll have an x86 binary and an ARM binary. But I bet you literally all the software I run is ARM binaries. Now, originally, it was almost all Intel binaries, x86 binary, right? But I didn't notice them being slow at all.
No.
Anyway, let's see. Where was I?
But I think that's an important thing for them to mention. I mean, it's a way to say you can migrate to this platform without worry, because we're going to emulate whatever you had before.
Well, this is, you know, so Microsoft's been working on this ARM for a while. Haven't the Surfaces always been ARM? Am I right about that? So I think
some of the Surface is such a blanket term for it's like MacBook.
Right.
So they have tablets that were labeled Surface. Mm-hmm. They have laptops that were labeled Surface. They had all-in-ones labeled as Surface.
But I remember going into the Microsoft store 10 years ago in the mall and playing with picking up a couple of their whatever tablet thingies.
I think
they were ARM. They were ARM.
I think the tablets were mobile chips and whatever those were. But they had like Surface laptops that were Intel based and all-in-ones that were Intel based. Okay.
Yeah, so this says app emulation has been a big problem for Windows on ARM over the past decade, but Microsoft did develop x64 app emulation for Windows 11. What does that mean?
Oh, from going 32-bit to 64-bit?
No, I think what that means, or maybe I'm wrong about this. You could be right, but what I thought that meant was when I'm running on ARM, it will emulate x64, which is like the 64-bit of x86, right?
Uh-huh.
So you got an ARM processor, but you can run x86 apps because they have this emulation layer. I don't know. You could be right, though. I'm not sure. This helps ensure that apps can run on Windows on ARM devices when there isn't a native ARM 64 version of the app.
Okay.
Native ARM apps are key for improved in performance. Yeah, well, they are. That's why while you do have to have an emulation layer for at least a transitionary period, ideally, you know, you're running ARM binaries for everything. Let's see. Microsoft is planning to ship consumer models of its upcoming Surface Pro 10 and Surface Laptop 10 with Qualcomm's Snapdragon X Elite processors instead of Intel's Core Ultra chips. These are all initially going to be consumer marketed.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to use the consumers as guinea pigs before they try to sell this to business.
Yeah, pretty much.
But yeah, they say the Snapdragon X Elite processors are next gen AI Copilot PCs.
Wow. What is a Copilot PC?
Oh, it's optimized for Microsoft Copilot. Copilot, all the things. GitHub Copilot, Microsoft Office Copilot, all the, you know, PowerPoint, you know, all these things. It just does
all Clippy there. All over again.
It does. It's Clippy, Clippy's grandbabies.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know. It's interesting. I think this is good. I mean, I don't run Windows machines.
No, but competition is good.
It is. And I loved it when I do feel like Apple took really a leap ahead with its ARM processors. And I'm glad that Microsoft seems to be, you know, getting in this game and competing effectively, because regardless of who your preferred vendor, OS, whatever it is, like, you want good competition.
Yeah.
Otherwise, who's going to keep the prices in check?
Right? True. Yeah. Although that doesn't matter with Apple. You're not going to keep their prices in check.
No one is immune from the, unless you, you know, can buy off all politicians and get all the regulations you want, which, you know, most of these companies pretty much do.
Yeah.
But you still are subject to the forces of supply and demand market economics.
Well, Microsoft definitely doesn't want to lose its foothold on its market share, essentially. But I think what worries Microsoft, in my opinion, is how well the ARM chips have been for cross-device play with Apple. I mean, if you think about it, you can run applications that were designed for iPad and iOS on these M1 laptops seamlessly. I mean, if you look at your widgets, they're seamless. They load, they run. It's just because they have that shared architecture, they're able to kind of do these cross-device plays very easily. And I think that's what the other ecosystems lack, is that kind of ease of interaction between the different.
You know, and someone was like showing me the other day, like, hey, I bought this, these earbuds. They're like AirPods, but they're like, you know, $30 instead of $250.
Yeah.
And the person was like, yeah, they're actually pretty damn good. And I was like, you know, I would consider, because obviously AirPods are
very expensive.
Yeah. I just bought my second set of AirPod Pros. Cause like, I don't know, I had the other ones for like a couple of years and they just got to where like they wouldn't seal or couldn't noise cancel or whatever. I don't know.
You just need a little retail therapy.
So I just bought a new pair. I'd been waiting though, because I thought they were going to come out with a new.
Yeah, no, but
and it's just,
they silently launched this next generation. This, I guess, is their second generation of Pros. But they haven't done anything.
Well, actually, the other benefit of me just getting a fresh pair of AirPods Pro is that my previous one, the only difference I can tell really is that it was Lightning. And the new one is USB-C.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have no Lightning left in my life, which is great.
Not even your phone's still Lightning.
It's not. I don't have an 8-year-old phone like you do, John.
Mine's the 15. It's Lightning. Look at the bottom.
No, it's USB-C. I promise. I charge it every day.
Mine's still, well, I don't know what I have then. I thought I had I had the 14.
I don't even know what phone I have.
About. You buy new phones like every minute.
iPhone 15 Pro. Dude, if you have a 15, it's not US. It's not Lightning.
How do you tell?
Well, plug it into something.
Well, plug it in. Oh my God. It's Lightning.
Yeah, this is not a 15.
Is that a 14? Maybe mine's a 14.
Yeah.
Okay. Toss my phone like
it's fine.
Garbage.
Oh my God, you have a case on it.
This old thing.
Yeah.
Can't believe I touched it.
This piece of shit out of my hands.
Need to upgrade.
Need
to go elite.
What do you need to get off your mind today before we wrap up this episode? Well, we still have to get on to release notes.
We'll do the release notes, but I have a gift for you.
Oh, you do?
Okay. I do, yeah. Now, this comes with a catch.
Okay.
You have to take a picture of this within a week.
Okay.
After assembling it.
Okay.
For our Slack channel.
Mm. Okay.
Hold on. This comes with a topic. Where is it? Flagged. Oh, I lost it. Uh-oh. Don't tell me I got rid of it. Anyways, recently it was Astro's 10-year anniversary.
Oh, God.
So in honor of that, I got you Cody building blocks. It was put on the Trailblazer store as part of the 10-year anniversary celebration. I think people had access to them at Dreamforce, where you could build them.
What kind of... Listen to this.
I know. I think they're super tiny bricks.
I think it's broken. It's just like...
It is broken. You have to assemble it. Anyways, I got one for myself, too. I'll build it within the week.
It has a lot of pieces. I'm going to have to get my kids on that.
That's what I'm going to do. Yeah. Child labor. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Hey, did you see that Oracle's moving to not Austin, actually. Shocking. Nashville.
Moving to not Austin?
Yeah. You would think, I mean, everyone's like moving to Austin, all these tech companies. No, Oracle is moving its headquarters to Nashville.
It's because Elon moved there and they were like, nah. Elon and Joe Rogan, they're so, like, nah.
Austin, yeah. Oh, okay. Well, release notes then.
No, where are they moving? To Nashville.
Nashville.
That's interesting.
It is. There's been a lot of relocations to Nashville, and I'm not sure what's going on there.
I don't either.
They have like really good like tax or employee policies or something, or I don't know.
That's a good question. Country's back in style. I don't know.
Yeah. Good point. I'm not sure.
Country kind of went pop for a while. So, but I've seen a resurgence of kind of bluegrassy country, not so much Taylor Swift country. Although Taylor Swift still rules the world, apparently.
It must be policies plus like cost of living. There's got to be some reasons that so many companies
are back to nature. A lot of people are moving to places they want to live because we're able to work remote. It's become just the norm these days. So I've known so many people that have moved out of whatever city they were in and into more rural areas.
Well, also, I mean, all these tech companies, I mean, Informatica's
not that Nashville's rural, but
we just talked about Informatica on this one, but I mean, Salesforce and all these companies, I mean, they're literally laying off just massive amounts of their U.S. employees and replacing them with, you know, India, Bulgaria, Montevideo, where's that? Uruguay?
Okay.
You know, and so people are, listen, you can't, if your employer can't afford to pay you what it costs to live in San Francisco, move to Sioux Falls or Nashville or Dallas or something.
Yeah.
Where it costs half the amount to live, and then maybe your employer can still afford to employ you. Maybe that's what's happened. Maybe that's part of it.
That's my theory.
Well, that's why I said cost of living. And if let's say you live in San Francisco and you need to make $300,000 a year, but you can move to Nashville and you only need to make $150,000 a year to have the same level of lifestyle. I don't know if those numbers are even close to being right or not, but
I would like to think that would balance things out too. I'd like to think that demand would go down in, say, San Francisco, and it'd be more affordable for people who just genuinely want to live there because they love it. I mean, that would be nice to see.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I hate talking. I mean, I work with a lot of people in California because that's where our company's based. So I can't stand to hear their stories about how much they pay for things in some of the places.
Yeah. Seems a little crazy, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
All right.
But you'll never hear them complain about the weather. Earthquake or two, maybe, but weather.
It depends on where you live. But yeah, I'm going to San Diego next week for my birthday, actually.
Nice.
And for a conference. I've never been to San Diego. It's one place in California. Well, one of the main, like, major places in California I've never been.
I'm trying to think if I've been there. I don't know if I've been there.
I don't know. All my friends are just like, oh, it's San Diego is great.
My brother's been there. He loves it there.
Yeah.
He was in the Navy, and they have a naval base down there. So
I've never heard a bad thing about San Diego. Yeah. Everyone's just like, oh, it's great. You know, it's like so much great food and beer, and it's like the weather's great, and people are cool, and I don't know. So,
oh, well, Jeremy might come back and pack his bags.
I know, be out of here. Except I can't afford to live there. That's the problem. I can barely afford to visit.
Well, you'll be fine with a studio.
Yeah,
a loft.
Okay, so. First release notes thing I got here was this expanded SQL query result support. And I haven't really dug into this, but basically I think it's in Apex. Yeah. So they call it Apex cursors. So, you know, like if you via like the REST API or SOAP API, I guess if you send it a query, you get back, you know, results, but also like a pointer to like the next page of records in this query result, like a cursor, but it's not a traditional database cursor. It's not in memory in the database or whatever. I'm pretty sure what Salesforce does is they take that result set and they probably write it into some kind of data store of some sort. So that when you come back, you know, a couple seconds or minutes or whatever later and say, next page, next page, next page, they're not going back to the database and reissuing that query, which could involve a table scan, right? I mean, no, they've already done that. They did that work once, and now when you want subsequent pages, they've already got pointers to all the records in that page, and so it's super cheap.
Wait a minute, what's the original context of this?
So, expanded SQL query result support. So,
okay.
Let me read this. With Apex cursors, you can break up processing of a SQL result into pieces that can be processed within the bounds of a single transaction. Okay. Cursors provide you with the ability to work with large query result sets while not actually returning the entire result set. So it's a limit thing too.
No, that's awesome.
Yeah. You can traverse a query result in parts with the flexibility to navigate forward and backward in the result set, which is cool. I mean, I guess they have the result set. Why not? Package developers and advanced. Are you, John, are you an advanced developer? Am I an advanced developer?
I think if you have to say you're an advanced developer, you're not an advanced developer.
I'm putting that on my LinkedIn, and I want everyone listening right now to go endorse me for advanced. So I'm an advanced Salesforce developer. Okay.
Are you a Ranger?
No, but I'm close. I'm actually getting close. It's only taken me 15 years, but
I'm negative Ranger. I'm the anti-Ranger.
What's the opposite Ranger? You're the one like going through the forest, lighting shit on fire.
And yeah.
Leaving your campfire, you know, leaving all your trash.
Yeah, that's me.
Food everywhere so the bears come.
I'm those idiots that were breaking rocks at the national park.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah.
Why did I see that recently?
I don't know. Because that happened recently.
Oh, God. Dumbass. Because
they put it on social media.
They're trying to roll rocks down the hill and stuff or whatever. These huge. Yeah. All right. Where are we? So package developers and advanced developers, but not junior developers. They can't do this. They don't have access.
Oh.
They can use cursors to effectively work with high volume and high resource processing jobs. Cursors are an alternative to batch Apex and address some of batch Apex's limitations.
Yep.
Cursors are also more powerful because they can be used in a chain of queuable Apex jobs.
That's what I was going to say. I think this is foundational for making queuables be able to be batchable. Because one thing I did learn about batch jobs is that when you run that query, that start at the query, and you run that query that says get the query locator, it will actually, for every batch, it queues all of those up. So it actually reads all the data and starts creating batches.
Preemptively.
It's not like it runs a batch and then goes and gets the next query set and then runs that. No, it does it all at once. Because what you can do is you can do a bunch of callouts or a bunch of DML in your start method. And it'll trigger the governor limits. That's how you test that.
Maybe that's because, John, though, maybe that's because that's a good point. I've never thought about this. But, you know, in database theory, there's like this whole idea of like consistent read or consistency. Basically, like when you started a batchable, you gave it a query, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, there were some results that matched that query.
Right.
Now, when you come back for your subsequent batches in that batch job or batchable, it's not a batch. It's a batch job. Batch job.
It's called batchable. The class
you
inherit.
You don't want the results of that original query to change on you. Like, you kind of need that to be consistent.
Yeah. Well, I'd rather deal with the inconsistency for performance than I would front load all the batches.
Depends on the problem you're trying to solve.
True.
True.
But that's how batch jobs work, is it front loads all of the batches. That's how you get that batch job that says 1 of 20 or 1 of 100. Yeah,
this works the same way.
But it's not a calculation. It's not like it says, there's 1,000 records in this result set, which will equal like 12 batches. So that's what I'm going to show. Mm-hmm. No, it physically runs and creates those batches ahead of time.
Does it, you think it saves all that data, like field values as they were at that time?
Yes.
Okay. So my guess is cursors don't do that. So if you need that, like, once I get my 120th batch, I need that account name to be as it was when I started this batch up, not as it is when I actually get to that specific batch.
Right. Yeah. That's the way I would expect them to work. Cursor. That's what I mean.
Well, so I think a cursor, no, I don't think that's going to do that. I think a cursor is basically a list of record IDs.
Yes. No,
but when you go grab a page, I think you're getting a page of records and Salesforce queries them. When you request a page, it queries them right then. And so you're getting the current values of everything.
Yes, that's what I would expect.
Not when the cursor was opened.
Right, right. I expect at the current time the page is requested. Because again,
these are not like traditional database cursors. Traditional database cursors, depending on what kind of isolation and consistency you've chosen, depending on who your database vendor is, because they have kind of different support levels for these things. But you generally, when you open a database cursor, It's consistent. And you know, a lot of database clusters are forward only for performance reasons. Some of them you can go backwards, but like it's still, which costs a lot more performance wise to be able to go backwards, memory and stuff.
I actually don't have many use cases to go backwards.
Well, you almost always try to not have to go backwards. I can't think of the last time I had to have a bi-directional database cursor.
Yeah. I've never come across a reason to do that.
Yeah.
Unless I was doing something really dumb when I was younger.
But regardless, even if it's a forward only cursor, the point is like you get a snapshot of what those records look like at the time that cursor was created. And as you're going forward, grabbing records out of it, and the database does all kinds of stuff, you know, it's optimizing its own memory, memory usage and everything, but it, you know, I guess proprietary or every database is a little bit different, but it's, they're using some kind of mechanism to get you a consistent view.
I mean, I think that's going to lead to much more performant code and less memory. What's the word?
This cracks me up. This is my favorite. You ready for my favorite feature? Yeah. New feature in the release notes. Find and buy Salesforce products faster with a product catalog. Oh my God. Okay. That was literally in the release notes. Why do I sound like I have emphysema? I've never smoked in my life.
It's just that good, I guess.
I guess so. okay, what's my next one here? So we talked about the support for 5-level parent to child relationship SQL. That's very useful. I'm glad they added that. The parent to child, multiple levels. Because before it was just one level, you could do one of those subqueries and that was it. This is an important thing. Now you have to opt into this. Yeah, well, you don't. You opt in by going to version 61 in your code, but this is one of those things when you're going to create your own programming language and your own runtime, your own compiler for it. Good luck with that. Cause I mean, they've had some of these kind of mistakes, but a subclass could override a private method of its parent class.
Yes.
Of its superclass, which is a violation of all kinds of encapsulation and security problems. But if you go to version 61 of the API, that's not permissible anymore. So I would recommend everyone upgrade your Apex to 61 because this is a problem. I mean, is it, you know, how often does that happen? I don't know.
Oh, it happens.
It does. And at minimum, it leads to really tricky bugs, really tricky, hard things to track down.
Yeah.
But at worst, it's a major security problem. All right. Let's see. Okay. In our state-of-the-art observability of Salesforce, which we call Apex Exception Emails, they now include the org name, the username, and the my domain. Wow! So when you get these emails, you can actually have somewhat of an idea of what org they came from. Oh, innovation, John. I mean, we laugh, but that is a welcome improvement, I guess. Although, really, we're monitoring our observability is via emails that get sent to us. This is terrible, terrible. This is no way to run and manage any kind of system.
I mean, I think more identifiable information on incoming requests is always better.
I agree. It's an improvement.
Trying to be positive.
I know. Oh, this is cool. This is a, what's the term? Non-applicable. This is relevant to my needs, something like that. So you're familiar with the upsert operation, right?
Yeah, I avoid it at all costs.
I avoid not using upsert at all costs.
Really?
Yes. Especially for integrations. Do you know how much more back and forth chat across the internet is where you have to like query for a bunch of external ID values to see if they exist or not. And if they do exist, then you send a batch of updates. And for the ones that don't exist, then you send a batch of inserts. That is so much more work.
You don't have as much automation as I do. So for me, the more expensive is updating a record that doesn't need to be updated. So I always query the data, bounce it against itself to see if it needs to be updated.
What's wrong with updating it?
Because it fires all the automation again.
Oh, and it was a note because like no values actually changed. Right. Yeah. That's a different problem. But yeah.
That's why I avoid upserts is because I'd rather validate that the data changed and I need to update it than the easy win of just fire it and let it save or update.
It'd be nice if Salesforce had some kind of switch or option that like when you're like, okay, I want to update this record. Because Salesforce is pretty efficient, I guess, about whether it's SQL queries, because they don't let you do like select star. They have to select like your individual fields. And then if you're going to update let's say you're going to update in a record, you can only include the field values that you want to send. Mm-hmm. And all the other field values will stay as they are, right?
Right.
Okay. It'd be nice if, like, you know, when you're saying, hey, I want to update this account, and the name should be Acme. Mm-hmm. But if the name's already Acme, it's a no-op. Don't do anything. Why is this not an option?
I think it's more complicated.
That's what you want. No, that's what you want. Let me just fire you a batch of accounts with what should be their current names and only do the update for records where the name is not what I'm saying the name it should be.
Yeah, that's essentially what I'm doing.
No, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. But that seems like what a great feature that would be.
That would be a great feature. Especially if it was just inherited into existing updates. Well, I don't know. I can't say that because some people do rely on, even though there's no, I've seen this, I've seen code written that does this. They'll just re-update the record. They might just send it just the ID and re-update the record with just the ID to get all the automation to refire.
Yeah.
They'll make no change, but they'll re-update.
Yeah. So then that's
if it's a DML option, that'd be great.
No, it should be an option. Yeah. Option for sure. Yeah. But to this new feature that this is relevant to my interests though. Update records using external IDs and REST API. So that's the name of it. They need to workshop some of these names. You can now update a record using the value of its external ID with the new update only parameter in the REST API. So you can basically send it a record or a batch of records and you want to upsert them, but you can say, I only want to update records. But basically, you're updating with the external ID. You're updating with the external ID. Uh-huh. And if it would have been an insert, then I don't know what happens. Is it an exception or does it just not do? Let's see. So what it does is it prevents creating a new record if the target record doesn't already exist. Mm. So I guess it just silently. It's probably not an exception.
That could be useful in a lot of situations.
Very useful.
Yeah.
Very useful. But I also think there should be an insert only option.
Yeah.
Like I don't want to update anything. Only, I guess you would just do insert in that case though, wouldn't you? Yeah. You would just
do insert. Because the point is you don't know that it exists or not. With an upsert.
Oh, yes.
You're offloading that decision to Salesforce.
Yeah. Yeah. Why would there not be an insert only? If you can do update only, why would there not be insert only? That just makes no sense to me.
I think it's just to prevent runaway data duplication.
Man.
Especially with the integrations, there's a lot of scenarios where you're like, this key has to exist. And rather than me doing the query to upload and get the keys to find out which ones exist and which ones don't, I can just updirt and updirt. updirt. I can just upsert and let it handle it.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, this is all just about efficiency. Because if you're having to like query to find out whether things exist or not and then send separate batches for inserts and updates, I mean, that's why upsert. I mean, Salesforce has supported upsert for a long time, huh?
Yeah. Well, if they can add that feature that only updates if changes,
that's a great feature.
Then yeah, that would be an awesome feature. Yeah.
And I give Salesforce permission to use my idea.
No, I want to check.
You want to check what?
For my idea.
Oh, you want a check to be sent to you? Yes. Yeah. Okay.
With lots of money.
Yeah. Me too. All right. So these Salesforce like integration profile, integration licenses, API only licenses, minimum access API only. This shit is so confusing to me. Mm-hmm. I hate it. And I do nothing but integrations all day. Yeah. And it's just, I can't, it's just so confusing. But anyway, we have an update here. We're updating the obsolete Salesforce API only system integration user profile from a standard to a custom profile so that you can delete the profile in orgs where it exists.
Why?
Because you want to be able to delete it.
Why would you want to delete it? It doesn't do anything.
Well, here's the why. It literally says why, colon, and I'm going to read the sentence. The Salesforce API only systems integration user profile. That's the name of it. The name of the profile is Salesforce API only systems integration.
I hate it.
User profile.
Because there's another API only integration.
It was replaced with the more secure, you ready for this one? Minimum access dash API only integrations.
Oh my God.
Profile. It's a profile. And the spring 24, but you know, profiles, these profiles are attached to certain license types. And that's, it's just, and like we had a problem with, I don't think our people figured it out because I just don't have patience for this crap. But like you couldn't, like you, maybe this is still a problem. If you have, what is it? You can't get it access to some objects and fields. If they're from, is it from the managed package? There's like nobody get them access to cert to like, if they're not built in, either not kind of like custom objects in your org or standard objects. If they're anything else, is it if they're packaged like managed?
No, there's some
installed.
There's some permissions that managed packages can create where they define the license type that is accessible. Yes.
Yeah.
And if they do standard license, then you can't use the API integration.
I have not been able to use this integration only license because of this, like many, many times.
Yeah. I've been using it, but I when that? We have vendors or somebody that we're trying to integrate, I'm not on Do Not Disturb, unfortunately.
Oh, that's you. Okay.
I make it part of my questioning is, do you guys support the API integration, integration account? And a lot of times the answer is yes, but sometimes it's no, because they have things that require access to some visual force process or something, which is weird, but
yeah, I mean, yeah,
because it's anything related to UI is obviously blocked, but also if they defined their permissions with standard license type, then yeah, it won't work.
And the last thing I noted was this scale test. Have you ever used this? What's it called? Scale Center, Scale Solution Center, or something like that?
No.
But they have this thing called Scale Test, and let's see. You have to have, if you have a full copy sandbox, then mm-hmm. what you can do is you can somehow schedule like performance tests to run. You can define them, create a test plan, you schedule it, and then it will puts this entire org and your test on like actual production, your actual production resources to see how it performs in your actual production environment.
Huh.
Very interesting.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I guess it's, I don't know if this is fully available. It actually is not saying. Oh, because I'm not in the release notes. I'm in something else. But I think I saw it from the release notes. Spring 24 release notes.
It says it's in preview.
Oh, well. Is it a preview?
No, the whole release notes are in preview. Sorry. I don't see it saying beta or pilot.
Yeah, I don't either.
Just says you'll be able to go to quick find and enter scale and you'll find scale test. That's interesting. I'll have to keep my eye on that one.
Somebody emailed me. This guy I've known for a long time, but they've had a consulting business forever, like a lot of Oracle and BPM, and I think they do a lot of MuleSoft now too. But they've finally, as like everyone else in the world, like, yeah, we've finally come to the conclusion we need to be a Salesforce consulting. I'm like, okay, well, great. Anyway, but they were asking about like, hey, what's the story on like, you know, here's what we're used to with like Datadog and all this monitoring of systems. We got a client asking us about like, what's the situation for observability and monitoring on Salesforce? I'm like, yeah, it's not going to be what you're used to.
No.
Let me introduce you to Apex emails, Apex exception emails. That's that's your observability.
No, you've got Salesforce Shield, which has monitoring.
So first of all, if you can afford Shield, it does come with, you can have more field history tracking and you can have more encrypted fields and some other things, but like, it's still nothing compared to what anyone's used to. There's no Datadog. There's no AppDynamics. There's nothing you would expect in terms of traditional observability, tracing, logging. It just doesn't. It doesn't exist. And I think Salesforce views that's their, and maybe this is fair. That's their problem to solve, not yours. Like, Salesforce doesn't want you having this big dashboard of the performance of all your Salesforce sites and experiences and internal pages and everything. They don't want you doing that. They think that's their job, not your job.
Whose job?
Salesforce's job, to make sure that's all performing well.
No.
That's what they think.
They can't think that.
Well, that's why you can't get logs. You can't get traces. You can't get metrics. There's no metrics.
Because if that were the case, trust would be updated real time with real information. Well, we go down all the time.
You don't have access to the internal trust. You only have access to the external trust, right?
Oh, is there an internal trust?
There is. My point is, we don't have access to it. Anyway. Well, John, I feel like this is, I've dominated this show.
Did you know we had an automotive cloud?
We have all kinds of clouds. We have a net zero.
I didn't know we had an automotive cloud. What is an automotive cloud? I just happen to see that in the release notes.
Is that compatible with a net zero cloud?
It says diagnose issues, driver safety, and vehicle performance using power of data cloud. I didn't know automotive cloud was a thing.
Yeah, you check your oil changes and make sure you.
My new Bugatti can talk to Salesforce and okay, got it. It's for those rich people.
Yeah.
And their yachts and
I mean,
supercars.
Right.
It's not for me and my Civic or whatever.
And Christian Louboutin boots and all that stuff, right? You have all those things, right?
Of course. That's a human right, Jeremy.
It is a human right. I declare it right now. It's a human right. Let's contact the World Economic Forum and make it happen.
Yeah.
Well, John, this is all I got. What do you, again? I've only got
cynicism left, so let's move on.
Well, what do you want to move on to? That's what I'm asking you.
No, I mean, let's wrap it up.
All right. Well, this is episode 321 of the Good Day, Sir podcast featuring your hosts, Jeremy Ross and John DeSantiago. As previously mentioned, to join our Slack, which you should do, you go to www.gooddaysirpodcast.com, click on community. We have an email address, info@gooddaysirpodcast.com. Anything coming up? Any other things to point out, John?
Nope.
All right. Well, it's another one of the books. I'll be traveling for a couple of weeks, so I'm glad we got this one in before I'm out. So,
yeah. We'll enjoy your birthday.
Yeah, we'll try.
Probably won't see you.
You won't see my birthday unless you're in San Diego.
I won't be in San Diego. Yeah. And to that, I say good day, sir.
You get nothing. You lose. Good day, sir.
Something like that probably goes all the way up to Benioff, and he's just like, inserting a link with Control K is unnatural. Aloha.